Kids can be so picky. What they like today, they don't like tomorrow. That is not a problem in our house because I always have Golden Blossom Honey on my grocery list. Thicker honey, better flavor. And I know it's a brand I can trust. You always know where their honey comes from because they put it right on the front label. Trust me, not every brand does it like that. Look for the green and gold label, and for lots of delicious recipes, check out goldenblossomhoney.com.
From Religion News Service, this is Saved by the City, coming at you from the Texas Tribune's Trib Fest in Austin. I'm Caitlin Beatty, co-host of the Saved by the City podcast, as well as the editorial director of Brazos Press, Woo Brazos, nice Texas name, and author of a couple books.
And I'm Roxy Stone. I'm the executive editor at Religion News Service and a co-host of Saved by the City. Caitlin! It's so good to see you in person.
Yes, I agree, Roxy. Yeehaw! We are recording live from the Lone Star State, and we have a spicy topic to tackle today with some incredible panelists. And what are we talking about?
Well, perhaps you've heard of the trad wife phenomenon.
I have. I seem to recall seeing something about it. This is a media ecosystem of conservative women inviting other women to lean in, not really in the Sheryl Sandberg way, but to lean into being wives, mothers, domestic goddesses. They're certainly stylish, very savvy. They have their own podcasts, book deals, and massive online followings.
So you're saying we're jealous?
Listen, these women know how to do their hair. And they usually have very beautiful kitchens.
Yes. But beneath the sourdough and matching family outfits is a politically resonant ideology that's shaping national conversations around gender, faith, and power, which is why we're here today. And we are so grateful to be joined by these three panelists. Emma Goldberg is a reporter for the New York Times. She covers cultural, societal, and economic change. Her article, Less Burnout, More Babies, How Conservatives Are Winning Young Women, was one of the reasons we wanted her to be part of this panel.
We also have Christine Emba directly to my left. She's a senior year fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, a contributing writer for the New York Times, and author of the book Rethinking Sex, and writes fascinating essays about gender norms today, the manosphere, the womanosphere, which we'll hear about soon.
And Lauren Southern is a former political activist and conservative influencer. She is the author of This Is Not Real Life.
Thanks so much for being here, you all. Can you also please say y'all, since we're in Texas?
Last week.
I guess not.
Lauren's Canadian. Let's start with you, Emma. You had a recent article for The Times describing the womanosphere. What is the womanosphere?
It's a really good question, and thank you for having me in this wonderful group. So the womanosphere is a realm of the internet that I became interested in investigating shortly after the 2024 election, because the election of Donald Trump stirred up a lot of conversation and a lot of hand-wringing about the manosphere, which is the realm of podcasts like Joe Rogan, Theo Vaughn, and others who are appealing to young men, offering them lifestyle advice, encouraging them to work out and eat more protein, and then also in many cases shaping their political beliefs. I was curious about what corollary there existed for young women. And I was particularly interested in this because I think young women is a demographic that we think of as sort of a reliably liberal stronghold. As recently as 2024, some 40% of young women identified as liberal. But it's also, when you look at the results from the 2024 election, a electorate that is shifting a little bit right along with the rest of the country. And so I started looking into all the podcasts and voices who are shaping the political opinions of young women. And there's a lot of really influential voices on the right in particular. And that includes Ali Beth Stuckey, who talks a lot about Christian faith. It includes Alex Clark, who's building a sort of army of MAHA supporters. And she works in the Turning Point universe. It recently includes Katie Miller, the wife of Stephen Miller, who followed that well-worn path of starting a podcast recently after the Elon Musk-Trump blow-up made her previous job a little less tenable. So it's a fast-growing universe of voices, a really influential one, and I think one that's worth exploring.
Christine, you've written a lot about the manosphere and what it suggests about a kind of crisis of identity among young men today. In terms of style, tone, political messaging, how would you compare these two gendered online spaces? How does the womanosphere compare with the manosphere?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. Also, thank you for having me. It's a delight to be back on the pod. The manosphere and the womanosphere rely really heavily on gendered tropes. I mean, in some sense, both of them exist to sort of enforce and popularize kind of traditional visions of masculinity and femininity, not just to, I guess, popularize them, but to show that they're correct, to say that they're the right path to go down, and that listeners, watchers, etc., should copy their style, their discussion topics, their tone, in the way that they live their lives. So to the extent that the, you know, Manosphere podcasts talk about working out and fitness and getting enough, you know, protein and stoicism and have kind of podcast backdrops that are sort of like man caves with energy drinks lining the walls, the womanosphere is kind of the feminine opposite, right? They also talk about the body frequently, but often in the sense of, you know, health and wellness and how to sort of preserve your female energy or exploit it in other ways. When they talk about relationships, it's often sort of how to be a sexy wife, how to celebrate your femininity, which is one of the taglines of Evie magazine, which was a sort of womanosphere alternative to Elle and Cosmopolitan that was founded in 2019. I think that the womanosphere is often seen as a little bit less, how would I say this, aggressive than the manosphere. You know, they don't necessarily always talk about politics immediately, but because they touch on so many other topics that, you know, have to deal with women's lives and eventually the way that women shape their lives, you know, you're talking about health and wellness, which leads to conversations about fertility, which then perhaps shapes your ideas on whether, you know, contraception should be used or being pro-life or not. You're talking about, you know, food and medicine, which then moves into questions about medicine, vaccines, etc. You're talking about child rearing and childbirth, which then leads to, you know, a very political question about, you know, how to shape a family life and what one's goals should be. So it tends to be like a little bit more subtle, but the messaging is very clear.
Lauren, you were once an influencer in this world. In your experience, what felt need is this content speaking to? What is drawing women into these more conservative, more traditional spaces and the lifestyles that are being modeled and promoted there?
Yeah, I think sometimes there can be a lack of curiosity as to why people are drawn to the kind of right-wing tradwife world. Obviously, I was in it. I know a lot of people who are still in that lifestyle. And I think, you know, there have been a lot of divorces in the modern age, a lot of broken families, and people crave structure. They crave control over their life. They want to know that there is something they can follow and get right that will ensure they have a successful life, a happy marriage, a good relationship. And I think that's a very normal and a very human craving. And in the absence of that, where there's a vacuum of culture and tradition, there hasn't been a new tradition created around kind of a more liberal view of the world where the woman isn't staying at home and both people are working, which quite frankly, there needs to be, because even the idea of the woman stays at home and works, it just doesn't mathematically make sense in our economy. Even the people who want to have the trad life and both the woman and man agree with them cannot economically do that and have children. So there is a vacuum, there is a lack of tradition and culture and for people to follow. So they're going backwards and saying, what did our ancestors do to meet success? If you've seen Tinder, if you've seen Bumble, the dating world right now, not a lot of people are having success. A lot of people are finding themselves older without children or single mothers or this or that. And so we're grasping for kind of traditions to follow. And I'm not sure that this one is coming up with the answers for the modern age either.
Yeah, this question is for all of you. It seems like when we're talking about the womanosphere, there are different cultural streams that are feeding into that water. Some people are coming to it because of a religious impulse or a Christian faith or other traditional faith. Other people are coming to it for overt political identity and messaging. Sometimes you come across it in your algorithm because this is a beautiful home or this looks like a beautiful family and the aesthetics are really nice. Maybe you are interested in beef tallow. You'll probably come across some of this content, like the wellness, health, natural remedies to ailments. So there are all these streams feeding into it. What is the one underlying current that's bringing all of these various streams together under one coherent worldview, if there is one coherent worldview?
First of all, I have to say that I love the the phrase natural remedies for ailments. I want to use that much more often. But in some sense, that actually kind of encapsulates what I think is the stream that brings all of this together. And, you know, I want to echo what Lauren was saying here. All of these sort of alternatives to what feels like the over-medicalized, over-commercialized modern norm suggest that something has gone wrong in modernity, that women, the lives that they are being told to lead right now or being forced to lead right now are not working for them. A constant undercurrent is that modernity, and specifically, you know, feminism as practiced today, has just made women unhappy and sick in some sense. So they need those natural ailments, you know, not successful romantically. So they need more advice on how to get a husband and be, you know, a sexy and happy wife, you know, not really good at taking care of their children or able to have the children that they want. So they need help with fertility. So basically, it just seems like there's this message that something has gone wrong, and these solutions are being offered that often harken to the past, basically, to tradition, thus the trad wife. And streams of that, this has gone wrong, there's a traditional solution that we should follow, this other thing is not working well, but there is like a traditional solution that we used to have. All of those streams tend to lead to the overarching trad wife space.
I completely agree. I also, what I've found in my reporting is that for a lot of young women, it comes down to this idea that has kind of been a strand since the feminist movement, but this idea that politics is personal. The personal is political and the political is personal. And I think when people hear voices that make these sort of big, messy political systems come down to the issues that they're thinking about on an everyday basis, their fertility, their health, the timeline for marriage and the timeline for their professional lives and how to kind of balance those two. When they hear people that sort of strip away all the politics and talk about those very urgent personal questions, that really speaks to them. And that helps them kind of feel like they have a pathway and a kind of blueprint for how to live their lives. What has struck me in a lot of the conversations that I've had with young women is that so many of the ideas that draw them to the womanosphere are kind of the flip side of left-coded talking points of recent years, too. So I've heard over and over on some of these podcasts this idea of, you know, professional ambition won't serve you in the way that a family will. And that was an idea that was exploding on the left during the pandemic. There was, you know, the Reddit anti-work forums were exploding. People were talking about how it was the age of anti-ambition and leaning out. And that idea was really prevalent on the left. But the right has kind of taken it and run with it too and lifted up as its answer to it, the trad wife lifestyle. And I've seen that in the Maha universe too. Like there's all of these sort of left-coded ideas about skepticism of big institutions, skepticism of the medical establishment and big pharma. But the right has, you know, taken it and run with it and proposed, as you said, beef tallow, you know, no more seed oils, throwing out birth control. I was especially struck by this. I did a story about kind of right-wing messaging on birth control. And I started reaching out to all these different women because I wanted to see if I could find someone who got off of birth control and got pregnant. And I did find a young woman who had just started to absorb all this sort of abstract skepticism about birth control on TikTok. She went off of it and shortly thereafter was pregnant and had to sort of rethink a lot of the other timelines in her life, like when she was going to get married and her career. And so I think this is having very real world immediate effects on people's lives. But it's stemming from these very big, messy questions that have been weighing on people on the right and the left for quite some time.
I don't know if you guys have seen those TikToks or reels where the girl will be getting frustrated because she's going to work and she's like, who gave me the right to vote? Who did this? I didn't want it. I want to be barefoot in the kitchen. I totally agree the personal and the political comes into play. I find one of the biggest problems with the critiques online of the trad life stuff is, once again, that lack of curiosity or assumption that the women who pursue it are doing it because they're not intelligent or because they were just grown up in indoctrination or something.
Right.
Whereas if you look back at some of the earlier feminists, right, like Andrea Dworkin in Right Wing Women talks about that idea of being private or public property. You can either be private property to a husband or you can be public property to the sea of men on Tinder or the mass sexualization of women or this kind of stuff. And there's a lot of people within the right-wing movement who are attracted to the idea of, okay, we are going to try to bring back an idea of, you know, I may have one man that quote unquote owns me, but I'm not going to have be in the workforce all day long with a boss and be enslaved to him. I'm not going to be mass sexualized by all these men online in the porn industry, which is also a big issue for women in the kind of right-wing trad sphere. Like, we're all being pornified 24/7 online. And these are legitimate issues that I think there could be crossover and agreement with the left and the right. But there's such a divisive conversation that has been created of you're the enemy, you're the enemy. So we can't solve them.
Emma, you started to nod at these, but you've reported from several conventions, conferences that are more conservative leaning. You wrote an article about Turning Point USA. You've been to what I just learned about upstairs. What was it? NatCon?
Natal
conference? MomCon? So you've been in these spaces. What are you hearing from the stage at these conferences or conventions? Is it overtly political? Is it more personal? What are you hearing from the stage and what are you getting a sense of from the people who are there about like why they're there?
Yeah, one of the sort of guiding lines of my reporting in recent months has been I've been trying to go to a lot of places where people are surprised to find a New York Times reporter just to like listen with curiosity to how young people's political beliefs have been sort of thrown up into the air and reshuffled in recent years, and I think especially since the pandemic, which really ruptured people's social and political lives in a really profound way. You know, as you were saying, Roxy, I've gone to a pronatalism convention, the Young Women's Leadership Summit, which is a Turning Point event, MomCon, which is what it sounds like, a mom convention. So a homeschooling convention, different groups and gatherings all over the country. And there are two themes that I've been thinking a lot that I've witnessed at a lot of these. One of them is that I've observed from interviewing dozens of people at these events that there's a little bit of a MAHA to MAGA pipeline that is drawing a lot of young women in. Young women are showing up at some of these events or tuning into podcasts like Alex Clark's because they're interested in, again, the questions that are weighing on their minds about their own bodies. Like, should they take hormonal birth control? What foods should they be avoiding if they're worried about their health or their fertility? You know, how should they be balancing exercise and healthy eating and parenting and all of that with their professional lives? And so they're tuning into all these voices and it is sort of leading them through the gateway of a more explicitly right-wing political universe. So that's one thing, and I saw that really strikingly with one young woman I interviewed in particular at Turning Point who had identified as pretty left-leaning. During the pandemic, when she was asking herself all these questions about vaccines and about birth control, because she was starting to think about getting pregnant, she started listening to some of these podcasts, and it just opened her eyes more and more to the more explicitly right-wing political universe. So that was sort of one sphere of themes that I've seen emerge. The other I would say is that I think that there's a little bit of a contradiction that a lot of young women at these events are grappling with, which is that they're being taught by a lot of these speakers that professional ambition will not serve them in the way that marriage and motherhood will. And yet they're hearing that messaging from women who have built really high-profile public careers on that idea that career won't serve you. And I saw that contradiction sort of embodied most explicitly, I think, with Erica Kirk, who
I listened to her and Charlie Kirk do a Q&A on stage at a Turning Point event, and they told the young women in the audience, don't ask us about politics because that's boring. Ask us about our lives. Like, come up and ask us about our marriage, our faith, why we observe the Sabbath, how we make time for parenting with our busy schedules. Don't ask us about politics. And there was a really striking back and forth where a young 16-year-old girl came up and asked them, she said, like, I came to this event because it's a leadership summit, and you're telling me not to have a career, and I don't understand that. And Charlie Kirk answered her, and he said, if you're hearing that message from a lot of really successful women, then maybe they know something you don't know. So I think it's a paradox that the speakers themselves haven't quite squared, but it's very much bubbling up for a lot of the young women drawn into this world.
We told you it was going to be spicy. Spice levels rising.
Lauren, you mentioned earlier that you wish there was more curiosity, maybe from mainstream media or more liberal-leaning folks. What do you think they're getting wrong or missing about the womanosphere or the appeal of these spaces or why people are being drawn to that? Where do you feel like the misunderstandings, the lack of curiosity, like where is that leading us astray in terms of understanding each other?
Yeah, I think what they're missing is that there is a place for the trad life. And I mean the real trad life, not the performative stuff you're seeing online. There's sometimes I find this issue where you'll talk to leftists and they'll tell you anyone can be anything. Anyone can be polyamorous. Anyone can go into the workforce and be a CEO. Anyone. And then you talk to conservatives and they say everyone needs to be X, Y, Z and everything has to be linear. But life isn't like that. You know, there's ups and downs, but there is a norm. You know, there is a norm that works for most people. And in a lot of cases, women staying home, especially after giving birth, does make sense. It does make sense for the man to keep working and the woman to stay home at that point. Maybe not for everyone, maybe some people the woman earns more, right? But there is a norm, and the family unit generally is very successful. You even have Bell Hooks talks about Leave It to Beaver. Like, that's a good family. She doesn't say we need to deconstruct that totally. But like Christine was saying earlier, there is this performative aspect, not just to the girl boss feminism where I'm rich and I'm telling you every other woman can do this, but this performative aspect to ballerina farms, for example. I'm going to make sourdough bread all day and I'm going to take care of my 200 children, but her husband's like the CEO of JetBlue, was it, right? And you have a lot of these very wealthy women that are showing a lifestyle that can only be achieved if you're very wealthy, even though it's being advocated for the average person. But it's performative, and almost every relationship you see on the internet is going to be performative because everyone's performing for someone. Even the person with 10 followers is trying to show people a version of their life that is the absolute best possible. But it's this total rejection of the need for the family unit and the total rejection of, you know, some women genuinely wanting that. There are girls that are like, yeah, I just want to be a wife and a mother, and that's okay too. That doesn't have to be rejected just because women should have the right to be a CEO as well. I think that's where the problem comes in. And this dismissal, I find something very interesting in this conversation right now, listening to you both talk about the influencers in the right-wing sphere, because I'm like in the fishbowl, right? And the people that you kind of refer to as the manosphere or the womanosphere, they're seen as the normal ones, like Alex Clark and Ali Beth Stuckey or Theo Vaughn and Joe Rogan. They're seen as like very like center. And then when I think of the manosphere, I'm thinking of Fresh and Fit or the Whatever podcast, these people that are quite frankly fighting with individuals like Ali Beth Stuckey and Alex Clark, who are saying, no, women should have a right to work. They should have a right to autonomy and a voice. And it's just like that Overton window within the conversation happening within the right-wing sphere and the conversation happening within kind of the mainstream media sphere. There's two entirely different conversations going on, two entirely different set of terms. I didn't even know the word womanosphere existed until the last few months when a journalist contacted me asking about it. I don't know where it came from. So I don't. The womanosphere don't even know that they're being referred to as the womanosphere.
Right. Well, I was actually just going to say, to point out what you were saying about some women feeling like they want somewhere where they're allowed to say, like, actually, I do want to be a wife and mom, or I do, you know, I do want to live a more traditional life. I think there's a sense of community also that draws people to, you know, the Turning Point, like Young Women's Leadership Conference, all these cons, right? These conventions that are bringing people together in community where they feel like they're they're in a group where it's safe for them to push back against what they see as the new norm. If the ideal that they feel like is being pushed on them is that of the girl boss, or, you know, this sort of modern vision of femaleness and being a woman in the world, there is a sense of, you know, wanting to have a safe space to disagree. And then if you do disagree, even slightly, like finding, oh, there are like a few people who agree with me. Oh, they all read this magazine. Oh, they're all listening to this podcast. And so I think it's just like a search for community as well. And that's also happening in the manosphere too.
Lauren, you briefly touched on the performative nature of some of this content. I mean, the aesthetics and vibes are very manicured and very often very beautiful or appealing. Let's talk about how much of this is quote unquote real. Like, not Ballerina Farm, because we know that's not real, but are the Tradwife content creators actually getting up at 5 a.m. to make their family of 200 children, you know, homemade buttermilk biscuits in heels, looking serene and sounding like having angelic voices?
Yes and no. For the ones who are getting up at 5 a.m., because I did that when I was trying to do the trad wife thing, but I was crying, you know, about some sort of fight that was had the night before or something. And then if I took a picture to post on Instagram, I'd be smiling for the picture, you know, tears wiped away. But everyone does this. It's not just a right-wing thing. I mean, we've seen a lot of performative leftists as well. It's just the wanting to be seen as successful, doing something right, having the perfect life. And after I separated from my husband, I pretended to be married and wore my ring on podcasts for 2 years after, because I was so embarrassed, humiliated about the idea of admitting that I had failed at this. So it's not just for careers, which, man, once you tie up your marriage and your relationship to your financial status, you have to double down no matter what happens. You guys could be, I know people that are still doing the online thing, pretending to be married, that have been divorced for years. But man, this is how we support our kids. So we gotta keep doubling down. And people are always going to prioritize their own family, their own well-being over telling the truth to the public. You know, that's the end of it.
Well, we have a few more questions for our panelists. And we also want to give all of you in the audience, in our live audience, a chance to ask some questions as well. So give a little thought to what you might want to ask our panelists. And we will come back to that in a second. But first, a shout out to the organization that makes this all possible. Religion News Service is an independent, award-winning source of global reporting on religion, spirituality, culture, and ethics.
From the East River to the Rio Grande and beyond, RNS covers religion across the country.
And thank you to Texas Tribune for this space and the opportunity to have this discussion at their annual Trib Fest.
If you liked what you heard here, we do have a weekly podcast, and you can find that wherever you listen to your podcast, including Apple, Spotify, Audio, YouTube. We're even on YouTube. You can also find us on social media, including Instagram, Facebook, even TikTok. You can also drop us a note at sbtcpodcast@religionnews.com.
Hilton stay, oh Hilton stay, your beds are soft and cozy. No lumpy couch, no stiff futon, no shower line at crack of dawn. Oh Hilton stay, oh Hilton stay.
When you want holiday comfort you can count on, it matters where you stay. Enjoy comfortable rooms and friendly service when you stay with Hilton instead. Save up to 25% this season when you book with Hilton. Hilton for the stay. Terms apply.
Does it ever feel like you're a marketing professional just
speaking into the void?
But with LinkedIn ads, you can know you're reaching the right decision makers, a network of 130 million of them, in fact. You can even target buyers by job title, industry, company, seniority, skills, and did I say job title? See how you can avoid the void and reach the right buyers with LinkedIn ads. Spend $250 on your first campaign and get a free $250 credit for the next one. Get started at linkedin.com/campaign. Terms and conditions apply.
Tito's Handmade Vodka is America's favorite vodka for a reason. From the first legal distillery in Texas, Tito's is six times distilled till it's just right, and naturally gluten-free, making it a high-quality spirit that mixes with just about anything, from the smoothest martinis to the best Bloody Marys. Tito's is known for giving back, teaming up with nonprofits to serve its communities and do good for dogs. Make your next cocktail with Tito's. Distilled and bottled by Fifth Generation Inc., Austin, Texas. 40% alcohol by volume. Savor responsibly.
Building a portfolio with Fidelity Basket Portfolios is kind of like making a sandwich. It's as simple as picking your stocks and ETFs, sort of like your meats and other topics, and managing it as one big, juicy investment. Mmm, now that's pretty good. Learn more at fidelity.com/baskets. Investing involves risk, including risk of loss. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. Member NYSE SIPC.
Over the last 20 years, L'Oréal Paris has honored 200 women of worth, uplifting their communities. Women who see the worth in every person, overlooked or underserved, who see an opportunity for change, who see a chance for better. They may be one of 200, but their journeys are always uniquely one of one. Here's to 200 more women of worth.
We're worth it.
We're worth it.
We're worth it.
We're worth it.
So maybe to start rounding out the conversation and then giving people a chance to ask their own questions, this is a significant online phenomenon, but we've already established some of it is performative. A lot of it is performative. The polling data consistently show, you mentioned this earlier, Emma, that young women have consistently broken left at the voting booth over the past decade. So in your view, is the womanosphere having a real political impact? Is it going to have a real political impact, or is this more or less cosplaying gender?
I think if you look at the presidential election last year, there was some indication that young women were moving a little bit to the right, again, like along with the rest of the electorate. But in 2020, Biden had a 35-point lead among young women. That shrunk to a 24-point lead for Harris in 2024, and that was a female candidate. And, you know, we know that, like, in a lot of elections, representation has a limited effect on how people will vote, but still that's a striking kind of change. So I would say, I think some of this, like, there's some indication in the data that it's real. I also just think that a lot of this points to, as I think both of you have said, it points to a sort of larger craving for meaning and community that is true and present in every demographic right now. There's a sort of cry for meaning and, like, kind of spirituality and purpose among a lot of young people, like people who grew up perhaps in disaffiliated households, not going to any sort of religious institution, just growing up in families that had a sort of skepticism of institutions. And I think this goes all the way back to the sort of, you know, Robert Putnam bowling alone phenomenon. Like, people just don't gather as much, and they look for something that's going to fill that meaning vacuum and that community vacuum. I did a story for the Times last week looking at the role that loneliness played in the New York City mayoral election, because it was a, you know, a completely shattering election with Zoran Mamdani, who is a 34-year-old Democratic socialist, winning over, you know, a New York, a sort of political scion, like someone who's been in New York politics for so long. And when I interviewed a lot of young voters and people who supported Mamdani, they talked over and over about how he got them out of the house. And I think it points to this sort of loneliness crisis that the Surgeon General has talked about, that religious leaders have talked about. Like, people have a craving for meaning, they have a craving for community, and they're finding it in online communities, but they're especially finding it in online communities that translate to the offline, whether that's Turning Point that's gathering thousands and thousands of young people, or any of these podcasters who are hosting live shows. I went last night for reporting purposes to Joe Rogan's comedy club in Austin. He's another person who has gotten young people from an online following to an offline, and I met them last night in Austin. So I think just like across the political spectrum, people are looking for meaning and community, and they're finding it all over the place. And their politics might still be up in the air, but they're, you know, they want that sense of purpose.
What have we missed? What was something that you really wanted to say that you didn't get a chance to say yet before we move on to the audience?
You know, I don't know that we missed much, but I think I want to just sort of like echo and elaborate on what Emma was saying. There's a desire for meaning and purpose and also a desire for just direction. You know, when we talk about modernity, you know, what Charles Taylor describes as liquid modernity, for instance, there's this idea that there's so many paths. There's so many choices that people have to make. And ideally, like, you can do anything. You have the freedom to be a girl boss or a trad wife or something in between. You can be a man, but, like, what does a man look like anyway? Like, we don't know. We're still deciding. And one of the things that I think is deeply appealing about any of these cultures, whether it's the manosphere, whether it's a womanosphere, whether it's, you know, a liberal equivalent, is that the best influencers, the best sort of practitioners, give people a clear path. They tell you what to do. They provide a map. You know, if you want to be a trad wife, this is how you dress. This is how you look. This is how you make cornflakes from scratch every morning for your 500 children. This is how you treat your husband.
They've had like 300 more children just in the last 30 minutes.
Their fertility is great, and yours can be too if you follow these wellness practices that they do. But they take confusion out of what is a very confusing moment right now. I think there is a feeling among some people that there's, some young people, there's almost a surfeit of freedom. So you're so free to make any choice that you want that it becomes paralyzing. And if you decide to follow a trad wife influencer, that decision paralysis kind of goes away. You might not get the results, but at least you have something that you know that you're supposed to be doing.
I completely agree with that. That's when I started writing my book, which is, you know, I still lean right, but it was an unpacking of a lot of the contradictions within the political right, a lot of the paths that I went down that failed because I was trying to follow a performative lifestyle rather than something in my real life. But I had to go back and unpack my evangelical background. What were the good parts about it? What were the bad parts? And I have a working class family that had a lot of chaos in it. There was addiction, you know, a lot of family trauma. And one thing that definitely gave me a stable childhood was my parents went and they were like, evangelical, we're not drawn outside the lines. We are going to stick to this because we know it's not going to lead to addiction or abuse or these kind of things that, of course, there are still people that performatively do this and that happens in the family, but they really tried their best. And it gave me a good childhood, a solid childhood. And I think there are problems there because people are more complex than some of the lines that are drawn in traditional lifestyle, and life doesn't always work that way, as I've seen with my own. But I also wonder, and this is kind of a question for the panel, do you believe there is a norm that maybe doesn't work for everyone, but works for most people? Because I think that's what a lot of conservatives are saying. There is a norm, doesn't necessarily work for everyone, at least the sane conservatives are saying that, but it works for most people. Do you believe in that?
I think one of the most compelling things that I've heard some of the influential voices in this space talking about, but sometimes not enough, is like the question of agency. Like, what do people need in order to achieve the vision of their lives that they themselves want? And this is something I heard this come up in sort of interesting kind of subcurrent ways at the pronatalism convention I went to, which was here in Austin, where the room was very, very male. It was a room of a couple hundred people talking about how to get women to have more children. It was mostly men. And one of the conference organizers told me, well, we wanted to have more women here and we invited more, but then they all got pregnant and dropped out. And I was asking people in the crowd sort of like what had brought them there and like why were they drawn to the pronatalism movement? Because again, I think like, yes, for some of them, they wanted a community. Some of them came there to meet people who agreed with them. Some of them came there because they feel a sense of sort of spiritual unmooredness and wanted a kind of blueprint for how to live their lives. But I spoke with a young woman in the crowd who told me she's really just interested in the question of what policies help women have the exact number of children that they want to have, whether that's one or two or three or five, and is it baby bonuses, or is it figuring out how to make housing more affordable, or is it sort of changing some of the social and cultural conversations around childbirth and child rearing and ambition? And I've heard the word reproductive ambition thrown around, which I think is interesting. But that was like where I think the kind of, you know, aperture focused in for me on just the question of agency. Like, there was a young woman in the room who was just asking, like, in all these conversations in this room of sort of like male thought leaders talking about how to get women to have more children, what about the question of just like how to help women have the number of children that they want? So I think, like, to me, it comes back a lot of times to a question of agency. Like, regardless of what lifestyle might be best, like, what about the lifestyle people want and what do they need in order to have it?
Do people even know what they want?
That's a tough question.
People want multiple things. I think that is part of the...
Because it's like Girard's mimetic theory. I think they're being told by the internet what they want.
Sure. Silicon Valley's favorite theologian.
I love
we
that
would
you guys
love
know about
to
that.
Hear from our audience. If you can come up, there are two mics. Just speak into the mic. And if you have a question for a specific panelist, please name that person or else we'll just, whoever wants to answer it can jump in.
I like choice and I like that people are complicated and they can change their choices. They can change any time in their life to be a trad wife or in between or whatever. I want to know what you think Project 2025 has influence over trad wives and the future of all of the other people who don't want to be trad wives, because that's what they want. They want us all to be trad wives. So I'd like to know what you think about Project 2025 and the fact that this movement has some insidious feelings about it.
It's a really, really important question, because I think in talking about the social and cultural questions swirling around all of this, you can't ignore the politics and the policy of it. And it reminds me of when I was working on this story about the kind of womanosphere stigmatization of birth control, I spoke with a historian of the reproductive kind of health movement who said that when she hears right-wing influencers stigmatizing birth control, to her, she recalls some of the efforts to stigmatize abortion and make it seem to people like unhealthy before there were even efforts to really restrict legal access to it. So in other words, social and cultural can always be the flip side of the political. Like when there are efforts to stigmatize birth control, when there are efforts to stigmatize women working, it of course like then creates some sort of cultural permission for people who might want to legally restrict those things. So I think you're very right that when there are social and cultural voices who are stigmatizing women having careers or stigmatizing women taking birth control, that can't be divorced from the legal efforts to, you know, encourage women to stay out of the workplace or, you know, make it harder for women to build the professional lives they want, make it harder for women to access contraception. So these things are very much linked together. And I think people who have studied the history of the reproductive health movement very much hear the echoes of that when they think about like the overturn of Roe v. Wade and the cultural and social efforts to stigmatize abortion that preceded it.
Can I add to that?
Yeah.
It's funny because within the right-wing space, there's this argument going on right now, which is very different than the public arguments happening, and it's the repeal the 19th question. But a lot of the particular right-wing rad femmes, which there is a sect of the right-wing that are women that have issues with Islam, having too much, actually they have very feminist reasons for being right-wing, you know, immigration issues, this kind of stuff, but they keep laughing at the individuals in the manosphere that say repeal the 19th because they're like, this is just never going to be a politically viable option. This is not happening. The second this actually gets put on the table to happen, all the women that were right wing are going to, you know, start voting against it. Even within a lot of the right wing sphere, the stuff that's super crazy gets laughed down. So don't be too scared. I don't think that's happening. I don't think Handmaid's Tale is right around the corner.
Well, I mean, probably we're not going to repeal the 19th Amendment anytime soon. I don't think that's in Project 2025, at least what they have publicized of that. But, you know, there is this idea that has proved very true that, you know, politics tends to be downstream from culture. And, you know, the womanosphere, these sort of trad wife influencers popularized these ideas that like, oh, contraception is bad. Oh, like women don't want to work outside the home. Oh, we should be skeptical of vaccines. We should, you know, we're just asking questions. And then, Project 2025, the conservative playbook is very, very large. I think one thing that liberals don't necessarily understand about, you know, conservative policymaking in the movement is that like people just sort of quietly work on questions and problems and policy for a really, really long time, for years or decades in advance, for the moment that it becomes, you know, possible to move into the mainstream. And so, I mean, even Project 2025, there have been leaks about this, that there is sort of a, you know, a master plan sort of that they are Master plan sounds bad, but I mean, but you know, like a set of policies that they have yet to publicize, but want to introduce to increase American fertility and to help increase women's fertility and write some of these strategies into law. And when the ground has kind of been softened by influencers being like, oh yeah, women don't really like working, right? Like women want to have this many kids, right? Like we're trying all of these different things. It suddenly becomes more palatable to put new policies into place because there's a defense. Like, oh, look, people are saying this. Women are saying they want this, so let's go.
I think the greatest, sorry, can I?
Yeah, I just, we have two more people, yeah. So I do want to get
the greatest that. Defense against like the most extreme political positions like that, that do kind of circulate through the media. A, I think a lot of them get exaggerated by both sides, you know, but is reality. Like the idea, okay, there may be a lot of influencers talking about how women don't like to work and don't like to be in the workforce, but realistically, everyone can look around them and know, well, I'm not, even the men have to admit, I kind of want my wife working because we can't pay rent. We can't have another kid if she's not working. And eventually these things, when they don't match up with reality, do cycle out like in a 5-year cycle. So maybe I'm just less worried about it.
Okay, we have three more people. I wonder if you could each ask your question and then each one of you could respond sort of to whatever you find compelling that you want to respond to, because we are almost out of time.
So I'm Marcy Hamilton. I'm a professor at University of Pennsylvania and the founder of Child USA. It's just historically true that as women increase their power, children increase their power and their rights. What really worries me about trad wives, as they call themselves, I mean, it's really Phyllis Schlafly 2.0, but what really worries me is the dangers to children right now. And I'll just give an example and I'll stop talking. I'm interested in your views. There's a woman in Oklahoma whose child has cancer and he's going to die from it if he doesn't get chemo. She took him off of chemo because she was influenced by the MAHA movement. The state, luckily, because that's medical neglect, it's illegal, you can't let your child die. The state intervened and he is getting the life-saving chemo he needs. The religious right in that state then backed her. That seems to me a tragic backing off of children's rights and protection, and I wondered what each of you are seeing in the trad world about children.
That's a really great question. Thank you, Marcy.
Okay, not a professor, but I liked learning about this. The ideas of love and power, I didn't hear those words. I heard choice and agency. I just know that the original traditional marriages were based on environments that did not include reproductive, financial, all of these choice freedoms that we have now. So if you're trying to put that in today, just do they make allowances for that, or where does the power go? Is it to the algorithm? Is it to the male? Is it to the blah, blah, blah? Or do they have a new way to present it that works with the freedoms and the choices of today?
Thank you.
And my question is about men and the role of men. We've talked about, I mean, the purpose of this panel is to talk about women, but where does the manosphere intersect with the womenosphere? What's going on the men's side in talking about not just the role of the man and the trad wife, but the role of the man and the boss girl and in between? I've seen men in my family evolve in their roles and how they support their wives. What's going on now with the younger generation of men and how they're talking about this?
Yeah, that's a great question. The masculinity crisis that prompted the womanosphere. Yeah, if we could just hear from each of you, we have to wrap. I know we are at time, but I think let's just hear from each one of you one more time and you can address those questions as you see fit.
Well, I guess I'll start with that last question because I think that's a really interesting, important observation. You know, some reporters have observed that some trad wife or sort of trad life influencers, female influencers, actually seem to not necessarily be influencing for women, but acting out a kind of male fetish, you know, wearing these milkmaid dresses and sort of like bustily, like moving about the kitchen and their lipstick and heels. They're appealing to the male gaze, not necessarily the female gaze. I think that one thing that the womanosphere does that kind of appeals to the manosphere and that makes a trad wife appealing to sort of these masculinity influencers is that that very extreme version of femininity confirms the opposite and extreme version of masculinity. It makes it very clear where the lines are drawn, who is a woman, who is a man, what role each of them plays. And then when it comes to also the roles that, you know, women are expected to play or pretend to play in the trad wife movement, you know, they're at home, they're taking care of the kids, they're a good wife. They tend to be sort of, you know, submissive and somewhat subservient, or at least kind of know their place in the home or not sort of interfering in the affairs of men in the broader world. And in a moment where I think a lot of men, often for economic reasons, there's just been like major economic change. There are fewer of the sort of strength favoring blue collar jobs that used to employ men. Men are going to college at lower rates than women and are in many cities being out earned by women. This idea that women, that trad women at least, you know their place and their place is not challenging men, their place is in the home, makes sort of these traditional leaning men feel kind of safe in their role, that at least for a little while longer, their dominance can be secure.
Emma?
Those are three really good questions. I think to the kind of the point you were just making, I do think sometimes like the focus on aesthetics in the trad wife conversation can cover up what is really a conversation about power. Because I too follow Ballerina Farm on Instagram and like sometimes find myself sort of like 30 minutes deep into looking at pictures of, you look really horrified, and I'm so sorry. Sometimes I go smooth brain, like, I just want to see beautiful pictures of
her
bread.
Her oven is nice.
Yeah, and her home, it's so beautiful. And, like, I live in a New York apartment. But I think that sometimes the focus on aesthetics in that conversation can obscure the fact that it's a conversation about power. Because when you talk about whether or not someone has a career, the underlying idea is like, do they have financial power to leave the relationship if it's not a healthy one? Like, can they support themselves? Are they kind of actualizing their own ambitions and dreams and putting their talents to good use? So I think like sometimes the when this becomes a conversation about the dresses people are wearing and the sourdough they're making and the protein powder and like exactly how many children they've natural birthed in a tub in their living room, it kind of takes the focus away from the fact that like really what we're talking about is whether if they need to leave the marriage because it's not healthy, can they, you know, or do they have the financial power to go build themselves a life on their own? And if they don't have that, then that is in some ways that, you know, a sort of rewinding of the clock. It's really important to keep the focus, as you know, you the question askers brought up, on power. The other part of this that I think in the questions you raised that's so important is that the health conversations have really important real life consequences, right? Like we're seeing measles outbreaks. We're seeing, as I said, like, you know, I've talked with young women who got pregnant after going off of birth control when they didn't want to be pregnant. And so I think that there, it's really important also to talk about the very real life, like bodily consequences of when people are asking very important questions about medicine, but then maybe kind of leaning a little bit too much into the skepticism or being subjected to misinformation, it can have consequences for their bodies and for the people around them who might get sick as well.
Right. Lauren, wrap us up.
I'll be quick here. Yeah, Emma, I think it's really interesting you talk about, we're not even focusing on like what people actually want when like the right wing portray this so much as the liberals want selfishness and we want to go to something higher. It's should be God ordained, the lifestyle you have. And then liberals talk about what you want, but I don't even think that's the dichotomy. I don't think we're asking what do people want? Does the power go to their own will and what's best for them? Or does it go to God or some higher order? I think one thing we've established in this panel is it's going to the performance. That's where the power is going. Everyone wants to look good. They want to look as though they have a successful life. The man wants his ego fulfilled potentially in this relationship. Because I don't even necessarily think people have the power anywhere in the relationship beyond what the outward performance and appearance is. It's not what's best for anyone. It's not what is actually giving people material power. It's what's making them look good on Instagram. It's what's fulfilling the ego. And none of it has a real application to, is this what's best for their life? Is this even godly? I think we've lost the plot on both of those directions.
Thanks so much for coming, everybody. This was a great conversation.
Thank you.
Please join us in a round of applause for our panelists. And with that, we will do our formal outro and let you go on to the next event.
Saved by the City is a religion news service production. The producer is Jay Woodward and the consulting editor is Paul O'Donnell. Our editor is Julia Windham.
Chaz Rousseau put together our look and Martin Fowler wrote our theme music.
We are Roxy Stone
and Caitlin Beatty.
Thanks for listening.
There's a lot of casino apps out there, but unlike some other apps in New Jersey, on Hard Rock Bet Casino, what you see when you sign up is actually what you get.
Try it for yourself. If you're not up money after 24 hours of slots, you'll get up to $1,000 back in casino bonus to play again.
Plus 200 bonus bins on Huff and More Puff. Wins paid in cash, no catch.
Hard Rock Bet Casino. Roll with us, Jersey. Offered by Seminole Hard Rock Digital LLC. All rewards issued as non-withdrawable site credits. Must be 21 plus and present in New Jersey to play. Bet with your head, not over it. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
The world moves fast. Your workday, even faster. Pitching products, drafting reports, analyzing data. Microsoft 365 Copilot is your AI assistant for work. Built into Word, Excel, PowerPoint, and other Microsoft 365 apps you use. Helping you quickly write, analyze, create, and summarize. So you can cut through clutter and clear a path to your best work. Learn more at Microsoft.com/M365Copilot.
Stock car racers are loaded with lights, sounds, and a powerful racing motor. Only at HessToyTruck.com. Free shipping and batteries included.